accession number 23140, reel 3.
The Cowboy Reel 3. You said that it was a bit hazy, but you said, I think, that you remember the breakout in August?
That's right. Rather curiously, we were told we were going to be breaking out. At that time, I had a new Lieutenant Lee, Gordon Lee, who was a Canadian loan officer, and he was briefing us on the attack, and he said, and we were going to this place called Dizul, and I said, I think that's pronounced Dizulay, sir. He said, well, easy come, easy go, we'll call it that. And it very remarkable, we followed back along the same railway track that I actually came in on, and it because there was a railway cutting building there, and it got Robber Home in big black letters on it. And we carried on through until we came to Dizulay. And at Dizulay, we had to cross the river during the night, and all the bridges were blown up, and we had to go across, and the water was up to your chest. Luckily, I couldn't swim anyway, so it's just as well it wasn't any deeper. When we got to the other side, of course, there had to be an attack put in on the Dizulay itself, for the railway station, and there was quite a few casualties there, but not in my particular section. We had quite a time of it until the following morning, and we were in this small wood, and we were attacked. We had three shots fired by a 88 gun, which is a self-propelled gun, sorry. And it's a very powerful gun. And I think probably the Germans' best gun. And they fired three shots. One went over, and one went short. And I thought, hello, ranging, being an ex-artillery man, realised that they were ranging, and the third shot came and hit the next slit trench to me, and it killed the boy that was in the trench. There was two of them in there. There was a corporal and a lance corporal. In actual fact, the lance corporal didn't belong in my section. He was from another platoon. I don't know why they'd put him in my section that day, but he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So that was one man that I lost.
What other details do you remember from this time?
Well, we were on our feet. We didn't have any transport at all, and we had to march everywhere. And we carried on until we came to a place called Pont l'Evêque, and that was the final stopping place for the 9th Battalion. I think the 5th Battalion went to the 3rd Brigade, rather, because the 5th Brigade went on to a place called Pont Adhémar, and that was the final objective for the para. Then we just came back to the beachhead, and we came back over the Mulberry and on a boat called the Empire Gauntlet, I think. Yeah, Empire Gauntlet.
What opinion had you formed of the German enemy from your first experience of them in Normandy?
Well, they seemed to be... I have Colonel had a very poor opinion of them, actually. He didn't think that they were very good quality soldiers. But from what I make out of it, they fought quite hard, and they didn't seem to have any fear. Can we scrub that bit? So. It was rather difficult because most of my contact with the German opposition was at night when you're doing patrols, and I know that the night we went out to do that patrol I mentioned, kilometre, and blew up the Breville Road, there was a German patrol that passed us, and we had to sit there tight while they went past. And of course, we were supposed to be a fighting patrol, but the main objective was to protect the gang that was going out to blow up the road, so we couldn't tackle them, and we had to sit quiet while they went by. But I should think that the Germans, a lot of the time when we were fighting against the Germans, we were facing the German para, and they seemed to be pretty good guys, you know. And that's about all I can say about it. I never really come into personal contact with a lot of them.
Did you form any opinion of the Norman civilians?
Didn't see a lot of them. The only thing I can remember is when they we got to Pont-l'Evêque, and they were shaving all these women that had been consorting with the Germans and cutting their hair off, and I didn't really take very kindly that sort of thing, but of course I hadn't had to suffer it.
How many women were having their heads shaved?
Oh, about half a dozen. As a matter of fact, at Pont-l'Evêque, my platoon commander and took our section, my section, down to reconnoitre a small wood just on the outskirts, and we went down a fence. A hedgerow, and on the left there was a farmhouse, and there was a girl there, and we went down a bit further, and my platoon commander's Batman was leading, and suddenly he came under fire from a 34 German 34 machine gun, which was one of those Burt guns, you know. Very high rate of fire. Anyway, he dropped his Sten, and we all ran. And the platoon commander said, "Let's get the hell out of here," in his typical American fashion, and Canadian fashion, rather. And as we belted up the road, we got out of there. But the following day, when I saw these women getting their hair cut, this girl was amongst them. So obviously, she was in cahoots with the Germans there. But we were lucky to get away with that. He didn't go back for his Sten gun, though.
But did you see who fired?
No, because that's a rather curious thing. I think what it was, where we got to, the machine gunner could probably conceal us under the trees. But once we started to run back, although it was in open country, he probably couldn't get a view of us through the trees. That's the only thing I can visualise.
How were these women reacting to having their heads shaved?
Very sullen and just not making a fuss at all. I don't think they were contemptuous, I should say. That's the only thing I can think of.
And nobody intervened?
No. It wasn't our place to intervene. After all, we hadn't been the ones that had been offended.
So you went back to...
I mean, I've been in situations since then, you see, in Palestine later on, where we've had to deal with civilian population rather more than we did in Germany, or France, rather. And you get to keep hands off most of the time. You know, you just can't interfere in things that's happening that are beyond your sort of job.
We'll talk more about Palestine later. Just one thing you were talking about when you were talking about the jump, you were talking about the green light and the red light. What was that system?
Ah, the red light. Well, as you come into the drop-in zone, you first of all, the red light comes on. You stand up and you put your... You check your equipment. You hook up your static line, and then you tell off for equipment check. That is, each man checks the man in front and says that his thing is okay. You've got to make sure that the static line is not interfering with you, and then you just pat him on the back and you say 18 okay, 17 okay, 16 okay, and it comes down to the front, say all the stick okay. So then the red light comes on and you shuffle up to the door, stand in the door, and then the green light comes on, and then you just go. And more of that later on, because when you get to the Rhine crossing, I've got a bit more to say about that.
So you come back to England after Normandy. Mm-hmm. What happened to you then?
Well, we had a leave. I'm not sure how long leave we had. And then we went back to Bulford. And we stayed at Bulford doing extra training, being reinforced. And we did one parachute jump just to get the new lads organised, to make sure they knew what was going on. And then the next thing was we found ourselves in Folkestone getting on the boat to go to the Ardennes, because the Battle of the Bulge had started. And on Christmas Day, I find myself on a little paddle steamer going to Normandy, going to Calais rather, and it was called the Royal Daffodil. And oddly enough, I remembered when I went on a school trip from Rye as a child, I'd gone down the City of London docks on a paddle steamer called the Royal Daffodil. Rather a coincidence.
What did you find once you got back to Belgium?
Yeah, we got to Belgium. We stayed overnight at a big abbey called the Abbey Marisseuse. And the following day, we carried on to Belgium. And, I can't recall exactly the name places of the place we went to. You know, we more or less taken from place to place. And we did various patrols. And then later on, we were moved to a place called Bandai. And at Bandai, I don't know if you've heard of it, there was a massacre on Christmas Day, apparently. And about 30 men of the village had been massacred in a cellar. And our battalion had to sort it out. And we acted as a burial party, and I think since then, every so often I've been, the trip's going back there. I've never been back myself.
What did you see of all that yourself?
I didn't actually see the place where the bodies were, but a lot of the men in the other companies were involved in laying the men out and putting them in their coffins, you know. Quite a horrendous business, apparently. So they'd just been left in, put into this cellar and massacred and just left there to rot. Wasn't until our men came there that they found out what had happened to them.
Did that change the attitude towards the enemy?
No, I don't think we liked them much before that.
What else do you remember from this time?
Not a lot. I think we, the only thing was we flew back, we went back to Ghent and flew back from there. It wasn't a very exciting time. It's just, I remember mostly the fact that I never felt warm. It's freezing. And I was in these slit trenches, and it was freezing all the time. I thought it was never going to get warm again.
Did you have any winter equipment at all?
Not really, no. And by the way, I took my boots off one night in my slit trench and couldn't get back on in the morning. And I got a rocket from Mr. Lee because I got called out for something and I had to put my plimsolls on. And he said, "What are you doing with plimsolls on in the snow?" He said, "Well, don't do that again." So I learned not to take my boots off after that.
What happened to you once you got back to England? Did you go back to Bulford again?
Yes, it was back to Bulford camp again. My next thing was we did went to London at one time. Now, I'm not quite sure when it was we went to London. And we did house clearing. No, we went to... I'm stuck there.
Somewhere in London?
Soon you stop there.
What do you mean? What do you mean by house clearing?
No, stop that.
I think the house clearing that you're talking about anyway was when earlier on, before you joined the Ninth Para.
That's right.
When
yeah.
you were in Leeds.
That was yeah. I'm trying to think what we were doing in London because we were doing some practicing with our stain guns anyway, but.
Well, don't worry if it's hazy in your mind. Let's go on to the Rhine crossing, and if you can take me through step by step what you remember about that, please.
Can I go to the toilet first? Because I.
Okay.
The Rhine crossing. We were at a place called Mushroom Farm in near Braintree in Essex, and prior to. Come in this time. We've been there for an exercise about a month or so previously, and no, it would have been about 2 or 3 months before. And we've made ourselves a bit of a nuisance, I think, because the boys went a bit wild and they went out of camp, and when we came back, we found they pinched practically every bike in Braintree and got back to camp on bikes. And at one point, they even pinched the bus, and we weren't very much liked in that area for that. But anyway, when we came to the Rhine crossing, we found ourselves back in the same place, in Mushroom Farm. And the day previous to the drop, we'd been well briefed as usual. That's one thing I liked about the para, that you got briefed. You knew exactly what you were going to do before you went there. Of course, it's hard luck when... It turns out to be like shambles, like the Normandy drop, but we weren't expecting the same thing to happen. So we took off from the airfield. I'm not sure where the airfield was, but it was local to Braintree. And funnily enough, we flew right over the top of Rye on the way out. And I wonder if that was in any way an omen, because I flew right over the top of my house and right along Camber Sands and headed out into the North Sea. And then we It took about 4 hours to get to Germany. And as we approached, I was hooked up on number one strop. I was the stick commander. But instead of being number, I'm shown as number 18 on my jump slip, but I hooked up on number one strop, which meant I was sitting facing the door. And as we came up to the Rhine, there's a vast panorama spread out in front of us, all guns firing. There was a smoke stream being laid alongside the Rhine on the near bank. And you could see that they were still firing guns, even though Para had been landed ahead of us. And I couldn't understand why the guns were still firing. But we came up alongside the road. There was a road that was across our path, and we flew up in V formation. And prior to the jump, I'd been to a stick commander's briefing, and the stick commander and the pilot had come over to me and said, "I've a very bad habit of forgetting to put the green light on." And he said, when you get over that drop zone and you see legs coming out, he said, if I haven't put the green light on, you'll know that I'm occupied doing something else. I'm probably trying to throttle back or something. And he said, I keep forgetting to put that green light on. So chuck them out. So anyway, we crossed the roadway and I saw these legs starting to come out. And I said, right, off. And the red light was still on. Now that's a court-martial offence, really. But it was wartime, and I thought, well, there's only one thing to do, and that's go ahead and do what he said. So I had about four out before the light went out, green light come on. But at that point, one of the men in the stick fell over. His name was Ruddy. Anyway, I managed to push all the rest out until we came to the last one, and then he fell over as well. So I thought, well, heck with that, and I jumped out myself. And just as I jumped out, I didn't know at the time, but a shell or an airburst hit the tail and the aircraft crash landed at Eindhoven. And the day after, these two guys that had fallen over came back and said, you're lucky that got away with your life, because if you hadn't jumped when you did, you'd have got down with that shell. So I consider myself very lucky. But in the meantime, there I was about 2 miles on from where I should have been, and I had to struggle all the way back through. And all the time around me was gliders landing and running into hedges, and guys were getting smashed up. But the thing was, you were told to go ahead and you had to get back and do your job, you know. And I just had to plug on and go.
How did you know which direction to go in?
Well, I knew which way to come in, really, because you couldn't tell from the way the aircraft were flying. But because they were all seemed to be flying in different directions. And I think half the American army was dropping about the time I was crossing the DZ. But anyway, I got about halfway across, and I got collared by the 5th RSM from the 5th Battalion. And he said, I've lost my sergeant. He said, and I want to put a perimeter around for the, I think the 5th Battalion, 5th Brigade rather. So I went off with him. I thought, well, I'm miles away anyway, and it's too late to get back in that position. So I went off with him, and I spent the night in that divisional HQ. And the following morning, I set off and I found my way back to my own lot. And Gordon Lee said, my platoon commander said, oh, well, I knew you'd turn up anyway. I said, well, thanks very much. That was the following morning. And then shortly afterwards, the other two guys turned up and said, you're lucky you got away with your life.
So you were dropped too far east, were you?
Yeah.
Too far into Germany?
Into Germany, yeah. Because the 5th Brigade dropping zone was much further on. It was the other side of the air landing zone. And to get back, I had to cross the whole thing, the air landing zone where all the gliders were coming down. I'd never been asked about that, but that's the way it happened.
Did you see anything of the enemy as you were making your way back?
No. The only person I saw, I saw a dead American. It was the first thing I saw when I landed, and I came into where I thought the RV would be. And I didn't recognise anybody at all. There was an American war correspondent there, but I didn't know who he was. And anyway, I shook them off and I started off on my own. But I got sidetracked because I came across some guys that had been crashed into by running into the trees. Apparently the glider pilot hadn't dropped his wheels. If he had dropped his wheels and gone in, it probably pulled up all right, but the thing had skidded right into the trees. And these guys were smashed to pieces, and I was helping to sort of lay them out. That's when this RSM came across and collared me. And I thought, well, they're strictly against the rules, really. You're supposed to make your way back and to your own outfit and fight with them, you see. But I knew I was so well adrift that they were probably more useful where I was, you know.
So you eventually got back to your battalion?
I got back to my battalion the following morning, yeah. Every morning you do what you call a stand to. It's before a half an hour before first light and after it becomes light. They do the same in the evening. It's to guard against a possible counterattack. But after the half hour is over, you stand down. Well, when I stood down then, I thought, well, I've stayed here long enough, I better get back to my own lot. So I went back to my own lot. And they'd been involved in a certain amount of action, but not much. A couple of guys were wounded. But on the whole, they'd managed quite nicely without me, so I was quite relieved about that.
So you didn't see much action yourself on this operation?
No, not at all, no.
Then what?
Yeah, I seemed to be lucky, and I don't know why it is, or unlucky. I never seemed to get beset by many problems when I land.
The cowboy reel for.